Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
On your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray, and Michael Hollmeyer is back with us for It's the Law section. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I am gritting my way through the Great Recession, Michael Ray.
You mean you're trying not to send pictures of yourself to people?
I don't know what kind of a rocket scientist one needs to be nowadays to know, based on what we've been through the last 10 years, that doing that kind of thing's maybe not a great idea.
Well, it depends on where you are and who you are. You know, Michael, you and I have talked about this before, the definition between dumb and stupid. Dumb is you don't know any better and you do it, and we all can do dumb things, all right. But stupid is when you know better and you do it anyway. And my major concern about this particular action from him was this is an elected official. Worse than that, there was a poll that came through out of New York that 51% of the people said, let him alone, he's okay.
Well, I guess they're entitled to have the representation that they choose, but it's a sad commentary that we can be in a society where, regardless of one's political views, the culture says this kind of activity is permissible. It's really not a privacy issue. It's not about his personal life. It's about the fact that the man looked everybody in the eye and lied. He got all of his supporters to take his side, only to find out that he lied to them. He undercut them. One of his supporters on TV said, I guess this makes me look pretty stupid. It really does. And somebody who would lie to their supporters as well as anyone else, I don't think, belongs in the Congress.
Michael, when you lie to the constituency, that's really the key. I mean, these are the people that our very lives are entrusted to, our financial life, our societal life. I mean, this list goes on. These are the people who set the rules of how we can live.
Well, they say this is gets back to our number of conversations we've had, Michael Ray, about the Washington elites, the New York and L.A. elites who want to be the folks, self-appointed, to tell the rest of us how to live our lives. I certainly don't want my 13-year-old taught how to live his life by these folks' examples if they are going to approve this kind of conduct. It's just not acceptable. These folks have no business telling us what to do.
And what it leads also is to this. I'm looking at, you know, I do interview after interview after interview and what's going on in our educational system today. Now, if somebody's going to be gay, if they're homosexual, that's up to them. Whatever somebody does behind closed doors is none of my business, and it never will be any of my business. That said, but the point is to start to teach it in the schools, start to socially engineer what these kids are thinking, which leads them to something like what Wiener did. It's okay. They do this constantly. They're texting this. They're texting that. They're showing naked pictures of each other at 12 and 13 years old, et cetera, et cetera. Michael, the list goes on. This is all being set from when they're very young on today. The culture today is so permissive that it's frightening.
It is very true, and that point gets driven home, I think, the most firmly when one has children. As you know, I'm recently remarried and became a stepfather, so I went from not having a child to having a just about teenager, and all of the stuff that you used to not notice when it was just you, conduct in a movie or language or behavior or whatever, you just didn't. Suddenly, when you're trying to protect somebody else from what is not appropriate for him or her, it definitely changes your perspective and it heightens your sensitivity to it. And it is extremely difficult to protect children from really conduct and behavior and images and influences that I think most people, regardless of their political persuasion, really would agree kids should not be exposed to.
Absolutely. This is setting the foundation of who they're going to be, how they're going to think. I'm going to go back to Wiener again. This kind of a thought pattern, that kind of behavior, and when we look at the, you know, the stats that run out of New York that was just mentioned, the 51%, this is the mindset, and it's a frightening mindset. It's a frightening mindset when you have a percentage of the people in this country who say, let everybody come in, it doesn't matter. Let the illegals come in. Let this one do that one. Everybody has the right to do this. We don't have the right. And that's, I think, where the key is. The guidelines are not set anymore. There's such confusion out there. Michael, you're up against it every day. I think there's a confusion in the legal system, in the court system, in what the definition of something is.
Yes, and it is the kind of game playing within the legal system that used to be unquestionably not allowed when I was a law student 27 years ago. Oops, did I say that?
Oops, I don't know. You were six.
But nowadays, not only is it allowed, but it's almost encouraged that people will, let's nitpick over what the definition of the word is.
Sure.
That's ludicrous. 25 years ago, that would have gotten you not only laughed out of court, but it would have gotten you sanctioned and maybe even tossed in the slammer for contempt. It's shocking and disappointing to think that the legal system has regressed to the point where they will allow this kind of intellectual gamesmanship that really lacks any true substance at all to persist. It's really a disappointment for me about what's going on in my profession.
Now, by the way, there is something else to take a look at. Somebody said something in the last day or so on air about that the majority of our elected officials, a lot of them are attorneys, and there should not be a lawyer that is voted into Congress, the House, the rest of it, et cetera, the President of the United States, because there is a mindset, and it gets to be when you get taught. And stop me if I'm wrong, and you know that I have nothing but respect for the law and you. But there's a mindset to get taught to use a strategy. The strategy is how to win, and it's got to be about winning and losing. And if you have enough people that are taught that mindset and to experience life in that way and the subject matter that comes up to them, then it's a strategy. It's about right and wrong, and sometimes we lose focus of what the real issues are politically.
I take no issue whatsoever with your critique of the legal profession. In fact, I second it wholeheartedly and with much disappointment. It's not about right or wrong, the legal system. It's about winning. It's about the game. And clients should always remember that it's their life, but it's only the lawyer's job. And I'm not saying that there aren't many lawyers who take that representation relationship seriously. They do their best, but there are all too many people. They might be described as the John Edwards types who forum shop, they judge shop, they rig, they play the system in order to get a result that enriches themselves and allows the game to continue. The game is no longer about justice. It's no longer about getting to the right result. It's who's got the smartest lawyer, who's got the best friendship relationship that gets a favorable ruling. And people have a right to wonder if our legal system should be personified not by a statue of the goddess of justice with a blindfold, but the goddess having the blindfold at least askew over one eye as she picks and chooses who the winners and losers should be. When the society starts to feel that's happened in the legal profession, and I think that the society does, and justifiably so, that's a very dangerous time that we're in right now.
And the horrible, I don't want to say horrible part about it is there's so many mixed messages and it confuses most people. And I mentioned this on the air the other day or so. What it creates is apathy because you just, you know, you get to a point where why should I vote? It's not going to count anyway. They're going to do whatever they want to do. Look at the reactions with some of the townhouse meetings from the elected officials to the people that were involved in the townhouse meetings. There's a condescending attitude that goes on right now. And it's like, but Obama, like him, dislike him, it doesn't matter. But now all of a sudden he's got, you know, a fleet of limousines, and there's money spent on this and money spent on that. And he's been golfing 71 times during the year, and they're counting all these things up. Now somebody could say, well, so what? But so what is, with everything going on in the world, you don't go out and golf 71 times. With everything going on with our economy, you don't increase the number of limousines that follow you around. So there's something wrong somewhere, and there is a, there's not a definable, this is who you are, and this is what you get, and don't cross over the line.
I agree with what you're saying. I also believe that an increasing number of the folks out there, not the the coastal elites, the governmental types, the power people, but the regular folks in between, in flyover country, they feel the same way that you and I feel. They have started to have their voice be heard, and it's a voice that says, enough, we're not putting up with this nonsense anymore. The election that we've just gone through in 2010 made a huge difference, and I don't believe that that wave has played itself out at all. I expect people will be back for more. The regular folks will have their voices heard again next year because they are as unhappy with what they see going on as you and I are.
Yeah, but see, the silent majority is not silent anymore. So I'm agreeing with what you're saying.
Correct.
There are too many
Yep.
people standing up. There's too many people saying, what is going on here? Let's go back to 2007, I think it was, when Nancy Pelosi was complaining that that the jobless the percentage was up to 5% and gas was $3. Yeah. This is horrible. And look what's happened.
Things have only gotten worse. Yes. Well, there will be a date due when that all comes due, and it'll have to be paid for, if you will. Things are significantly worse than they were, without question. People know it. But you see, it's your fault.
Sure.
It's your fault because you represent the new media, and the new media is the game changer. It's what's changed everything because you are a source of information for people. You're also a means by which people can voice their reaction to that honest information that never used to be shared with them. So you help get the real word out to people so they know it's not what they had been told by the mainstream media, and you give them an opportunity to have their voices raised and heard by others, which gives people a sense, I'm not the only one who feels this way. And that's why I keep saying, Michael Ray, that you and I are not voices crying in the wilderness. There's a huge groundswell of regular people, good Americans, who support the same kind of common sense feeling and want us to get back to our roots. And these people are encouraged and reinforced by getting the straight scoop from you and others in the new media, and by hearing that other people aren't taking it anymore either. We're all getting together. That's what's brought about this revolution. It's the new media, and for that, you have to take part of the responsibility and part of the credit.
We also have to have a visible plan. I mean, there's no question about that. We've got to be able to navigate through this very complex system that we've created. And, Michael, I have to say it's a reversible cause and effect. Whoever you and I did or did not vote for or whatever, when it comes down to it, it is still a we. We have allowed it to get to where it is. We've allowed some of the politicians to become who they are, and you can't seem to touch them for some reason. And I do believe, and it's what you said, I'll expand on it, that there is change coming. There's a tremendous change coming, and we're going to see what happens. Half of those, the new jobs that they're bragging about in the administration were, if you've heard it or not, half of those jobs went to McDonald's. Go figure.
Right, which is not the American dream job. And also something else, too, is people aren't buying the you-know-what that the mainstream media is shoveling, that the government is shoveling, that the Democrat Party is shoveling. People are not buying it. They don't believe it. They don't believe that this country has gone over a cliff and can never return. Instead, they feel things are bad, conditions are worse, but we can fix them if we take the reins of power back, if we have a truly representative bunch of people in government who are really representing us and not themselves. And I believe that they're right. And so those people, as long as they feel they can fix this situation, they will show up next year to fix it.
Oh, and by the way, when we're dealing with this, they've got to have the ability, when I say the ability to recognize that there is still hope. There is a possibility of changing things. We have not gone, we have not gone so far that we're, that we can't come back and become who we were. And I really believe that the family has got to take over. The family, not the government, not the school system, but mom and dad, because mom and dad don't have the definition that mom and dad had 10, 15, 20 years ago. They laugh at mom and dad today because what does mom and dad know? Mom and dad doesn't know anything about texting. Mom and dad doesn't know anything about the way the world works. So there is a there's a lack of respect there. There's also a lack of respect because every kid knows that if they really don't like what their parents are pushing down their throat, that they've got they've got child welfare, they've got the police department, these kids are in a place right now that they can really do no wrong.
Yes, and this isn't a question of do we throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not a question of, you know, we either protect children or we don't protect children. I think the challenge of living in a democracy is always finding a balance. If you say we don't want guns in school, do you really want to throw a kid out of school and expel him because he brings some teeny miniature one-inch-long replica of an ancient firearm to school for a project? No. And yet that kid will get expelled because we have the inability to make commonsensical distinctions. When we say we want a drug-free campus, that doesn't mean that a kid can't bring an aspirin to school.
Sure.
People get angry because we're presented with a twisting of what we mean to be an either-or thing. You know, if we're going to prohibit illicit and illegal drugs, then we have to prohibit aspirin. Come on. That's crazy and ridiculous, and we don't appreciate your reducing the argument down to that kind of inane. That's what makes people angry, and people say, we will take back our responsibility of choosing how to strike the balance and be active participants in our own self-governance. We're no longer going to allow other people to say, we can run the show better than you, we're smarter than you, we have better instincts, and you're just a, you know, a hillbilly. We don't buy that anymore, and those people are going to come out and vote next year.
No, and by the way, let's take it a step farther. You know, the aspirin is such a quote-unquote, I say this tongue-in-cheek, horrible thing. Then what about passing out condoms? What about sending kids to the doctor to get abortions without their parents' knowledge? Where do we cross the line there? Where do we say this is horrible, this little silly aspirin, but it's okay?
Great question.
Yeah.
And the answer to it, I think, is we have let people take power from us, and we need to take it back legally, peacefully, the way that we're entitled to, but we have to actually step up and not just complain, but step up and say we want to take back our responsibility to govern ourselves, and then we will exercise that responsibility. You know, we kind of let it dribble away, and thankfully, this administration has more quickly than might otherwise have happened, without such a stark contrast, really brought everybody to realize, hey, what's going on? Look how far we've gone. It's not too late to say, I see where we are. We can come back. We will come back. Big part of that is we all have to take responsibility for standing up there and saying, I'm okay with your teaching certain kinds of education, but you're not just not going to be allowed to take our kids away from us. You're not allowed to take our rights as parents and our responsibilities as parents away from us and turn us into children and wards of the state as well.
And you don't get rid of dodgeball because if somebody gets hit by a ball, they've got to go see a counselor. I mean, we're getting ridiculous with these things. Michael, it's one thing that I remember as a kid in school. We had wood shop, we had auto shop, we had metal shop, we had all of these different shops whereby everybody is not going to go to college. It's not going to happen. So there's nothing for those kids today to go into these kind of shops to learn the manual trades to do what they're doing. The dropout rate is tremendous. If somebody's not going to go to college, then what do they got to look forward to? And how do they prep themselves to get into those particular positions? There's nothing offered at this stage of the game. So in essence, we have an educational system that doesn't really truly mean educational. If I was in your position, and don't hear that I think you should do anything that I would do, and I'm talking about me personally, and if I met a woman and I got married and she had a preteen or a teenager, when we sat down the name of the game would be, there's a new sheriff in town. It's my rules, and we better get at it right now if you're not going to follow the rules. My rules wouldn't be ridiculous, but my rules would also be rules that would keep them out of trouble, learn consequence, and learn respect.
Of course, that kind of a conversation takes place, I think, with any prudent people who are contemplating, you know, trying to blend two families together. I did that in my personal life to make sure that we thought the same and that we'd be able to agree on the message that we wanted to share as parents. Obviously, since I was coming in, if you will, you know, I had less innate authority, but it was like, are we on the same page? Because at best, if we're not, we're giving mixed messages, and at worst, it's going to lead to an inevitable breakdown. So, yeah, we're on the same page. We think the same way. We have the same values. We think those values need to be passed on, and they need to be believed in, not just lectured at, and that's what we're striving to accomplish. You know, you're right. These are timeless values. People have to be able to agree upon them if they're going to be able to effectively transmit them. I like to think we're doing that. It's a huge responsibility. It is made more difficult by the depth to which the culture has sunk. But all of this stuff that we talk about as being less than ideal or bad, if you will, we can fix it. We're not too late. We're not too far gone. We are, after all, Americans. It's our birthright to take responsibility and to improve things. We've done it since before the country was founded. We can do it tomorrow. Even if things look to be in terrible shape, we can definitely do this. All we need to do is step up and start taking our power back, and that certainly has to happen next year.
Sure, and the first rule, and we're running out of time, but the first rule that would be in the House, no matter what, would be if you use a four-letter expletive to your mother and your voice is loud when you do it, if we live in a three-story house, you better learn how to fly.
And don't send any email photographs of yourself.
Yeah, that too. Hey, Michael Hollmeyer, website we can find you at.
We're at www.hollmeyerlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, see you next week.
Looking forward to it, Michael Ray. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Joni Aldridge coming up very quick.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be.
Joni Aldridge with us. She's the author of Connecting Through Compassion, Guidance for Family and Friends of a Brain Cancer Patient. She's also the author of The Saving of Gordon, Lifelines to Win Against Cancer, The Cancer Patient Win Book, Our Cancer Fight Journal, and The Losing of Gordon, A Beacon Through the Storm Called Grief and Connecting Through Compassion, Guidance Again for Family and Friends of a Brain Cancer Patient, and Understanding with Compassion, Help for Our Loved Ones and Caregivers of a Brain Illness Patient. Joni, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael Ray. I bet you're wondering why my titles are so long.
Not really, because I think the titles in and of themselves, there's a message in the title. So when you pick up the book or you go after it, you know exactly what you're getting.
Exactly, and that's the whole reason behind it, although one of these days I am going to write a short title book.
Nah. Okay. Now, by the way, when a patient has a diagnosis, you know, and between that point and the beginning treatment for cancer, whatever that treatment is, what is it that the parents go through, the patient and the family? Because there is a fear, there's no question about it. All of a sudden, life the way you knew it is not the same, and there's a high potential that the patient may die. And that patient could be 12 years old or 70 years old, but it's still the same. That period, how do you deal with that from the diagnosis to the first treatments?
Well, obviously, the biggest thing is the uncertainty, and you're going to be in a sense of urgency that, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, you're not getting from the medical community. They're hearing elevator music, and you're on the fast track because your life is in limbo. You're in a state of uncertainty. You don't know where you're going to be. And I tell you, one of the worst things, and I've been in this three times now in 7 years, catastrophic issue. You wake up in the morning and you think, man, I just had the worst nightmare. And then you think, oh my God, it wasn't a nightmare. It was real. And if you don't have a plan of action, a plan of attack, then you really, really get frustrated and nothing seems to be going fast enough. Now, sometimes you have to make tough decisions. Sometimes you have no choice but to wait, and sometimes you need to not wait. In the situation with my husband, Gordon, he had a tumor compressing his spinal column that was causing him debilitating extreme pain. And we had found the tumor, and he was told it was going to be 4 weeks before he could get in to see a neurosurgeon. Well, we couldn't wait. So the number one thing you want to do is get copies of those medical tests. And we ended up at the emergency room that night. The attending neurosurgeon was shocked he could even walk. And we didn't have to wait those 4 weeks. The surgery was the following week, and it's a good thing because it ended up being cancer.
By the way,
now,
let me
ask. Not always going to be the case because sometimes they're just going to stabilize you and send you home.
Yeah, but Joni, and here's the question, realistically. How does a medical professional diagnose something that serious and say it's four months or 4 weeks before you get to see anybody, knowing that the potential of not being able to make it is there and it's greatly there? Thank goodness you were smart enough to get to the emergency room. But what do you do in the average case? Most people will have no idea what to do.
And that's unfortunate, and that's one of the things that I try to teach people, you know, through my writing. That was one of the reasons why I felt this was so important. I just went through this again with my boyfriend who has a brain tumor, and a very large brain tumor. And, of course, you go through the same thing. I had a lot more connections this time, thank goodness, but it still didn't change the end result. What you have to do is you have to lay out the pros and the cons of taking action now and what can you do and will going to the emergency room help, because in some cases it just won't.
Now, so, by the way, the other side of that is dealing with the patient. There are patients who, and I think especially in today's world, who are not emotionally strong in the first place. And they get a diagnosis like that, and they start to fall apart. And one of the biggest problems that I can see happening is the stress on the immune system, and it's the immune system that's going to either make it or break it for this person coming through or not coming through. So it's got to be a real challenge, not necessarily even for the patient, but the people that are around the patient that are responsible for taking care of that patient. It's got to be a nightmare unless you know what to do.
Well, and one of the great things that I've mentioned in talking about this subject is that you need to define your resources, and I call them your A team. And basically, one of those A teams would be anyone in that facility that you want to get into, and you know, obviously this is a big key thing with me. Location, location, location is everything when you have a difficult medical situation. But one of the things is if you can find somebody or you know somebody that works in that facility, you know, and they can pull a little string or check to see if they've got that. More recently, dealing with my boyfriend, I was able to find out that his DVD had been received at the medical facility, and wow, was that a relief, because
sure,
it had to go, you know, four states. But it's amazing how much just that little information comes in handy. And as I said, if it becomes critical, if you just feel you cannot wait, then go to the emergency room. I mean, just bite the bullet. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. You have to even be careful with that a little bit.
Well, sure, but the doctor in and of themselves, because a doctor is a medical doctor, does not necessarily mean that he or she has the expertise in a particular area. And I think the word networking is probably one of the most critical words that somebody can be involved with. But if you don't know that that's going to happen and you go into the doctor's office and all of a sudden they spring on you, you've got cancer, and it's not good, and you've got a whatever degree of it, then how do you know about the networking? I think that's where the problem is. It's not prepping ahead of time, and most people just don't think about doing that.
Well, it's an unpleasant topic. It really is. You know, we like to network about things. Again, this is another key point in life, you know, that we do on a daily basis. I even wrote a press release that said, you know, network about cancer before it even happens to you, because you need to find out other people's experiences, because that's a great deal of information. There are 11 million cancer survivors walking among us. And they're a great, and they want to talk. They want to be a part. There are whole organizations that will put you with another cancer patient that's been through something similar with you. But if you shut down and you don't let the information in, then you are losing a valuable resource. Now, you know, in The Saving of Gordon, I outline what I call my WIN method. And one of the things that you have to know is that networking is just one small piece. You also need to do your web research, and if you're not computer savvy, you know, find somebody. If this is another member of your A team, find somebody that can help you kind of sort through that. Somebody's medically inclined. Your cousin Dave, twice removed on your mother's side, you know, who just happens to be a real geek on the computer, or has a little medical knowledge, and interrogate your doctor. Ask the tough questions.
Listen
for the little details when you meet with your doctor. The key little things that you can hear, things like, this doctor is the best one we have at this facility. That's a scary statement. Because is that the best doctor at any facility, or just the best that you have right at that facility? And that's how critical it is.
Now, by the way, one of the things in your press release, which I think is extremely important, that time between the diagnosis and the first appointment, what do you do? What are some of the steps that you take to get you prepped for that first appointment?
Well, one thing about it, staying active and getting some things accomplished, being a little proactive will make you feel productive. And certainly, we mentioned calling on your A team. You have to consider that when you do meet with that specialist, things can heat up very quickly. You might be thrown into surgery the day after. You just don't know what's going to happen. So do you need help with child care? Do you need some senior care? That's a problem that a lot of us are faced with these days. What about pets? Who's going to pick up your mail? Set up a prayer chain, you know, get in touch with people at your church that, you know, might be able to help you. You know, keep the things at home ready to go. Keep your laundry up, and who's going to take care of the yard work. But certainly make sure that your financial things are in order. Deal with your insurance company up front. Call them. Ask them questions. Plan for ways to pay for the deductible. Get your living, the thing that we all hate to talk about. Make sure that all your legal paperwork is up to date. Healthcare power of attorney, living wills, these are all important things.
Now, by the way, when we go through this, when you're prepping for this, there's no question about that you would have to do everything that there is. But about planning for the financial burden, you know, most people don't realize what kind of costs that are getting involved. What was it, 13, 14 years ago, I got sick, and it was just an operation. Now, luckily, I had insurance, but that operation was over $50,000. You know, and so when we talk about the kind of payment for medical care today, it's not just $5,000 or $10,000. You could be talking about $100,000, $150,000, and especially in this very questionable financial market that we're in right now, where does a person get that? I'm not really asking the question specifically, but where do you get that kind of money? What if you're not properly insured? And what if you can't get insurance? What do you do in a case like that? You just don't say, okay, I've got the diagnosis, I'm just going to get my things in order, and I'll go die somewhere.
Well, you know, I always look at it from this viewpoint, and I know it's not as simple as it sounds. You can live without absence of money. You can't live without absence of life. As a matter of fact, I just had a very, very good friend that passed away last week who never had a dime of health insurance and was treated for 2 years at the University of Indiana for his cancer. And, you know, had very good treatment. So, you know, there are financial aid groups available at most hospitals, social workers that can help you with some of this. But one of the things you need to make sure of is what is your insurance cap? You mentioned the cost of insurance, even with insurance. For example, my husband had 3 outpatient stem cell transplants. While his lifetime cap on his insurance at that time, which seemed like a lot of money, was $1 million. When I go for insurance now, I don't go for $1 million. I go for a cap of $3 to $5 million because literally that's for life, and we were butting up against it. You know, unfortunately, he did not make it, but that was something that we would have had to have faced in the future. Another thing that you definitely want to do, talking about finances, is if you feel comfortable doing it, talk with your employer in advance and ask them, you know, what their options are should something happen. And by the way, it's not just the patient anymore. With a serious illness such as with cancer, a lot of times the work issue affects the spouse as well, who becomes the caregiver and may also be out of work for a while.
Okay, so realistically, there's a roadmap to go through this if you get it. Because if you don't have the insurance and if you don't know what to do, and I've known for years that there isn't anybody who can't get taken care of some way, some form, somehow. If your kids are sick and if you don't have any insurance, there's organizations in every city that will take care of them, and on and on and on. So you can deal with this, but most people have no idea of this. So I think that what you're doing, I'm going to say, is absolutely brilliant, because I wonder how many lives you'll save by doing this. And more people should get the book. It's called Preventative Medicine. Why not? You don't know in today's world when a diagnosis is going to come up and what's going to happen to you after it's done. So it's not only the patient, but it's the support system of the patient that's critical. It could mean the difference between life and death.
And certainly my book, The Saving of Gordon, Lifelines to Win Against Cancer, is a step-by-step. It's been called Having Your Hand Held Through the Cancer Experience. And, Michael, it was a book I wanted handed to me on the day that my husband was diagnosed, just as Connecting Through Compassion is the one that I wanted handed to me the day that he was diagnosed with metastatic brain cancer. It even has chapters on financial aid and places that you can go for support. So, you know, it's a great tool for finding out, you know, kind of helping you through the process.
Now, by the way, we're running out of time now. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes. It's www.joni.aldrich.com, and all of my books and products are on basketofcare.com. And please have your listeners go and look at, there's a ton of information there. Now, I need to just say one more thing, too.
Sure.
That's very important. If you find that you do have a medical emergency, make sure that you have your test results ready, up-to-date list of medications, and here's one thing that people don't know a lot of times. If you call 911, if you just go to your phone and call 911, the rescue vehicle that comes to take you to the hospital will take you to the hospital they're associated with, unless it's a private transportation service. So you want to do some investigating on that in advance, too.
That makes sense to me. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much for having me. Anytime.
Thank you. Good night.
There are so good night.
Fabulous, faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Seth, do we have a guest?
And Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Incredible places to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Danielle Spiraccio is almost with us.
I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Danielle Spiraccio is with us. She's an artist, she's a teacher, and she's a mom. And after being pregnant at 19, she went on to graduate from school at Visual Arts in New York City and got a double major in fine arts and education. A current graduate school student, she's won many scholarships, grants, and art awards, and she's the author of From Darkness to Light. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and you?
Yeah. Oh, I'm good. Did I pronounce your last name right? Oh, good. Okay. You know, the former teen mom speaks out about stereotypes. What is it today that causes so many youngsters, quote unquote, to get pregnant? They realize what the consequence is, and if they're 17, 18, 19 years old, life kind of stops, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really hard being pregnant at a really young age.
Now, by the way, what caused you? Now, this happened to you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what happened afterwards? You were told that you were pregnant. Where did that go? How did the family accept it? How did you deal with it?
I didn't tell my mom until I was almost like 6 months pregnant because I was scared. And my boyfriend wasn't sure if at the time if I was pregnant or not because I didn't understand half the stuff. And I thought when you have sex, you could wash it out. Mm-hmm. And apparently you can't.
No.
And so I kept it hidden from my family for 6 months. And then I told my mom that I might be pregnant. And I went to college. And I showed my teacher my stomach. And she said, you know, you could possibly be pregnant. And she said I should talk to my mom. And then my mom got upset a little bit, but she accepted it. And
yeah.
She said to me, I'll be always there for you.
Now, by the way, so your mom stood behind you with this?
Yes.
Good for your mom. That's a mom that, you know, that's a keeper. That's somebody you want to keep. There's so many kids today that happens to. And the family, quote unquote, they're so embarrassed, they're this, they're that, and they really stop thinking about that youngster who's going through it, and they think about themselves. So, you know, hooray for your mom, you know, major applause for her. Now, you find out you're pregnant, you know your mom's got you back, so you're covered there. But what was it like going through it? How did you deal with your friends? How did life actually change for you?
Everything I kept like a secret, and I was dealing with being like verbally abused by my boyfriend at the time, and I thought things would get better, and it didn't, apparently. It just escalated worse, and his side of the family got upset, called me names and everything, and I thought things would get better from there, so I eventually did marry him, and it was very difficult because I was getting like a lot of negative feedback from certain people saying you're never going to graduate school, you're never going to be able to do anything with your life, you'll probably be a stay-at-home mom, you'll never graduate college. I had my grandma, Josephine Vance, like she went to school with me at nighttime because she was worried about me traveling in the city to school back and forth from 95th Street to 23rd Street at nighttime. Because I was doing double major, fine arts, art education, plus internship and everything. And it was very, very hard for me.
Well, sure. Well, I can imagine it was. But you have the strength to move through it. I think that's the most important thing that you can really deal with at this stage of the game, is that you did have the strength to do it. Now, if you were going to talk to other kids, what kind of recommendations would you give them? And you can't tell somebody today to not to have sex and because you can get pregnant. My goodness, you know, 10-year-olds know that. What kind of advice can you give kids? What can you say to them to take to make them take a second look at the possibility of what could happen?
That they could get pregnant if they don't use protection.
Yeah.
Basically, everybody says abstinence, but there is, like, no real abstinence. People are... not going to do that.
No, it's not going to happen.
Right. No, so I think people should use, like, safe sex, like, you know, use condoms or birth control or whatever.
Yeah.
Parents should actually be more open with their teens about practicing safe sex, basically.
Yeah. Because, now, by the way, we know about safe sex. I mean, there is no question about it. You know, we've got to a point in our lives, Danielle, that everything is taught to everybody in school. I guess the real question is how do you make them listen? How do you make them take advantage of it? I mean, you can't make anybody do anything, but they're, you know, they say education, education, education. We know all this. I mean, there's no secret to this. It's called how do you get somebody to practice? I think that's really the problem. Not an easy question.
Yeah, I guess just telling them to use condoms and birth control because it's really, really hard, like, raising a child, like, not only emotionally but financially, and especially if you wind up being a single parent, it's even harder.
Yeah, no question. How old is your son now?
He's 11. He'll be 12 years old March 15, 2012 now.
No, okay. No, this is good. This is a great thing. So he's 11, and thank goodness you kept him. You were a mom. You know what? Well, your responsibility was modeled after your mom. Your mom did the right thing. You did the right thing. And the boy himself, how is he doing? How is he turning out?
He's doing very well. He actually has ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactive disorder. He's on medication every day to function. He sees a psychiatrist once a month, and I see one too. For paranoid schizophrenic. I was diagnosed that right after I had my son.
Let me ask you about that diagnosis, you know, that you were diagnosed that after you had your son. Were you like that at all before, or did
No.
Go ahead. Yeah, so you weren't like that at all before. None of this was going on.
No, I was like that right after I had my son.
Yeah. Okay, and then all of a sudden you saw yourself going with the highs and the lows and the highs and the lows. And then, now the ADHD, anybody else in the family have it?
Not that we know of.
Okay, yeah, but the one thing, when it all comes down to it, with, you know, mental illnesses, et cetera, the stability that people look for to be able to balance their lives out, at base, you still have your son. Is your mom still around?
Yeah, my mom helped me a lot. My grandma, Josephine Vance, like, she helped me a lot. She helped me even financially a lot, too. She was very supportive of me going through school and everything emotionally. And every time I had a problem, I went to her. And, like, she would pay for a babysitter for my son if I needed it and food or whatever. I also had help with WIC for a while for formula. And then in between, I was working and then not working and going to school full time. Sometimes I'd take my son to school with me some days, and it was really, really hard.
You know what the interesting thing is that when you're, you know, when you're 8, 9 years old, 10 years old, 12, 15 years old, there is nothing to prepare you for having the child. There's nothing on earth that can get you ready. Most people go through life, and life is accidental, but they really don't go through processes in classes. I know there was a class at one time that they had years ago that all the young girls would have dolls, and they would carry this doll around 24 hours a day, and it was like practice being, you know, being a mom. What's it like being responsible, carrying this doll around constantly? Everything you do, you have the doll with you. And they found dolls in the garbage cans thrown under the bed. That thing called responsibility, you can't be taught it until it actually happens to you. Now, are you speaking to other young women?
I am speaking for all young women. Because, like I said, it was very hard, but like I made it through.
Yeah.
I had to learn how to sterilize bottles because I didn't even know anything about sterilizing bottles. And I had to learn different things, a lot of different things.
Now, by the way, your mom helped you with all of those things as far as learning that?
She did, because the hospital tried to explain it, but like I wasn't grasping like anything what they were saying. And then they referred me to a social worker, and then they said to me, you know, you can't live in two places with your child. You got to pick one place to live and stuff. So I had my mom take care of my son on certain days on Long Island, and then I was traveling back and forth from Long Island to New York City on certain days.
So, by the way, all of these things that you've gone through, have you found that it's given you a strength that you'd never had before?
I always been a pretty strong person. I had to deal with my dad passing away when I was 17, turning 18.
Yeah. Well, by the way, what did he pass away of?
Asbestos, which turned into cancer, and it went to his brain.
Wow. So dealing with death is not an easy thing. But then again, too, on the other side of the coin, dealing with life is not an easy thing either. And there are many people who go through all these challenges and these concerns that you run into. And I really believe that falling down and getting back up again, no matter what life throws at you, it gets you stronger each time. Now, have you gotten married yet?
Remarried?
Yeah.
Or no, I'm very afraid to get remarried again.
Okay, so because of the way the original marriage worked?
Yeah, because I was, like, really deeply in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, really hurt, like, so deeply hurt.
Yeah.
Because, like, he was my real, true first love.
Sure.
And, like, he was very special to me. And, like, we went through, like, a lot. Even though, like, there are good and bad, like, he was abusive and stuff to me. He was abusive to my son. And I had to go through, I think, 5 or 6 years in and out of the court system for family court, domestic violence. Cost, like, I think, $20,000. And I had a really wonderful lawyer, Taya Williams, who helped me.
Now, by the way, getting through all of that, and realistically, and I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times, but all men aren't the same. You know, when the time comes and if you get re-ready again, that special him may be out there that's not going to abuse and can respect who you are and allow you to be just as much as you possibly can be. You've been through a lot of things. You've made it through, and you're still young. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are still out ahead of you. Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, how's the book been going? Have people been buying?
I'm not sure, honestly.
Okay. All right. But how long's the book been out?
I think since May, I think.
Okay. All right.
Or April.
So, okay, the book's been out since May. All right, so it'll happen, it'll come. By the way, I have the book in my hand, and the book is looking good. The book in and of itself, is there? Do you find that there's going to be another book after this one?
I'm actually trying to write it in poetic form.
Yeah.
Other stuff that has happened to me that I didn't speak about.
Now, oh, by the way, do you have a website we can find you at?
www.danielsparacio.com.
Okay, and can we get the book there?
I'm pretty sure you can, and you could go to Ex Libra's website and Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Okay, by the way, thank you, Danielle, for being here, and tough way to go, but maybe your story is going to reach somebody else out there that hears it, and maybe they don't have to go through all of that, and maybe some of these youngsters that are not being very careful about their sexuality, maybe they'll hear the message, and who knows? Your book may save a life out there.
Okay, thank you.
Again, thank you for being here. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Gray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Maureen Santora with us spent 27 years as an educator in the New City Public School System. The dynamic mother of five and child advocate has been listed in Who's Who and American Educators. She's also the author of My Son Christopher and We Remember. All proceeds go to the Christopher A. Santora Educational Scholarship Fund, and that's at www.christophersantora.com. She is the mother of the youngest fallen 9/11 firefighter, and she's here with us tonight. Maureen, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, what an absolute tragedy. Let's go back to that time. You knew your son was there. He was involved in it. That must have been frightening for you.
Well, I when I saw out the window, it was very, very frightening. And I thought Christopher was on his way home because he had worked the night before. So initially, I never made the connection that he might be there. And we got a call around 9:15 from his firehouse asking that he returned. And then I knew he was there. I knew he was down there. But I assumed, like a lot of other parents and relatives, of 9/11 victims initially that they had gotten out, because it was incomprehensible that this many people would disappear. So in the early days, I was hopeful that he was going to come in the door, or maybe he had amnesia, or, you know, we'd get a call from a hospital that he had been injured, but he was okay. I just couldn't process the fact that my 23-year-old son might be dead. So initially, I was, you know, I guess hopeful that he was going to come back. And then, of course, when the reality set in, it was just probably the most devastating thing that ever happened to me.
Oh, sure. Now, there must have been a tremendous amount of anger. I mean, there's no question. The grief, yes. But the anger that this could happen to somebody right here on our soil, and especially being your son. How'd you move through that? Because with anger comes hate, and with hate comes it's just self-destroying.
Well, my husband was very angry. He had been in the fire department for over 40 years, and he was very angry at a lot of things, you know, that occurred. I, on the other hand, was just so profoundly sad and cried all the time. I didn't get the anger part until much, much, much later. And the first couple of years, I was just overwhelmingly sad. And I started to write. And I wrote, and I never looked back. I never checked my writing. I never read it. I just wrote. And I closed the book, and you know, I would go on with whatever activities I had to do. And I'm now a person that's very frustrated and very upset at what's going on currently at the site. But initially, I was not angry at all. And I couldn't understand how anybody could have this much hate in their heart. So I went out to try and figure out how somebody could be this hate-filled in their own life. But my husband was very, very angry, and he was in a very bad way. And, you know, we ended up, both of us, you know, going to counseling to try and resolve, you know, the issues that we both were feeling. And they were both different reactions to the same situation.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, there are people who go to counseling, and they're told to go to counseling, and they go to counseling forever, and it doesn't really do any good. But when you run into a situation like this, sometimes you need that third party, that somebody who can listen to it from a neutral place and then work it out. Because there's things that would be inside you and your husband that if you didn't have a professional that knew how to bring it out, would stay there internally. And if it was internal, that could cause a lot of problems down the road.
That's correct. And, you know, we know a lot of 9/11 families whose husbands and wives have separated because of this event. But Al and I walked this path together. And as I said, we had very different reactions. And I think one of the best things that I learned was that, you know, although we felt our world had ended, and I felt my world had ended, and I had, you know, four other children, but this was a devastating. I just, you know, can't reiterate that enough. It was just overwhelming to me. But the counselor said to me, you know, time will force you to mend. And what she said was very profound, because that absolutely is true. At the time, you know, you can't think of getting to the next hour. And then you're not only at the next hour, but you're at the next day. And, you know, I was very concerned that I would go through these bouts of this, you know, very, very profound sorrow. And I just felt horrible all day, you know. And she said, understand that although you don't think it's going to pass, it will pass. And, of course, it did. And so that helped me as well. And I now have bouts of tears even today, but I know that it will pass, and I'll be on to a smile or a laugh, or I'll see my grandchildren doing something that's very delightful, and it'll just bring me joy.
By the way, as a parent, it is always, Maureen, it's always going to be with you. There's no question about it. It's called what you turn it to, and I've talked to many people over the years that have had traumatic experiences in their life, losing loved ones to getting maimed and so on and so forth. And then sometimes, and they've done like what you've done, you put this to pen, And people looking at and reading it, it doesn't necessarily have to be about 9/11. I'm sure that people will relate to their own lives with experiences that they go through on a daily basis, and sometimes losing someone. Losing someone is losing someone any way you look at it. But sometimes those things that you've gone through, and like within the book is a legacy to your son. I mean, there's no question. The book is there. It's going to stay there forever. It's going to live. And in and of itself might do some good for somebody else out there that reads the book who maybe have lost someone and didn't think that they could get through it. And it doesn't mean that when you say you get through it, you're going to run through life smiling and happy and it didn't happen. It happened. But it's managing what happened. And if the book can touch a few lives, then what a great gift that you could give to your son.
Well, that's the reason that I wrote the book. I wanted parents to know that they needed to tell their children every single day how much they cared about them and how special they were, even if they were not perfect. And my son, in the book, I don't describe him as perfect because he wasn't, but he had wonderful gifts, and he always knew that I appreciated those gifts, and I would tell him every day that I loved him. And so for me, that was a great resolve that I was able to be able to say to myself, my son knew how much I loved him because I told him all the time. And he would, you know, bring me to great frustration and anger at times. And then he'd crack a joke and we'd, you know, we'd laugh. And that was a skill that he possessed. But, you know, he was just an incredible person. And, you know, I didn't want my children to be the same as everybody else. I appreciated all their individual gifts, and I think that's very important to teach children that that they are special and they don't have to be like everybody else, and that their parents will love them unconditionally no matter what happens. And those were the things that I wanted parents to know, and I wanted kids to know also that, you know, it was the parents' responsibility to make sure that the children turned out to be wonderful, productive adults. And sometimes that meant that you had to have restrictions, or you had to have curfews, or you had to be told that you were doing something wrong. But that's a parent's job. That's a job that we're giving when we become parents. So I wanted the children to know that it's, you know, it's done, you know, because of the vision that parents have, that they want their children to turn out to be successful and happy and have love and, you know, good things in their life. So I felt that was very, very important to do.
You know, by the way, I'm looking at the title of the book, you know, My Son Christopher and We Remember. An interesting tagline, excuse me, on that book would be, excuse me, I'm sorry, My Son Christopher and We Remember. And the tagline would be, because I'm listening very closely to you, a wake-up call, because you may not be able to say what you want to say tomorrow.
Yes, and I think that's correct. That's correct. And, you know, I always lived my life as though it were my last. So I've really had a wonderfully blessed, wonderful life because I haven't gotten caught up. And, you know, everybody gets aggravated about a lot of things in their life. And when you're younger, you become more aggravated, I think, than when you're older. It seems that way to me anyway, but I really felt that it's very important to cherish every day and to look for the rainbow. And, you know, you mentioned early on about the devastating loss, and it occurs across the board with any kind of profound loss, any kind of trauma. A person makes a decision on whether or not they are going to move ahead or stand still or move backward. And if you're honoring somebody, you know, in their death, and you want people to know about them, then you must move forward. And you must make the death meaningful. And you must let people know who this person is and who this person was. And you must move forward and you must go ahead. And it's very difficult to do that. But it can be done, and it provides you with a new kind of life. I'm a new person. I'm a different person than I was before September 11th. And I'm okay with that now. It was hard in the beginning, but I'm okay with that now.
Now, by the way, in the very beginning, when you talk about moving forward, in the very beginning, if we quote-unquote do it for them and leave that strength, let that strength, you know, push you forward, and then when you get to the point where you can actually realize it and understand it, then you know you're doing it for you. But in the very beginning, they would not want to see you destroyed.
That's correct. Well, I knew my son. My son was very opinionated. He was the only boy with four sisters. And so he was very vocal, very opinionated, was passionate about being an American. He was an American history buff. He majored in history in college and became a teacher in New York City for a short time. Very, very passionate about being American. And I knew in my heart that Christopher would have been very angry if his parents had just shriveled up and not continued their life. And so we made a very conscious effort to honor him by, you know, being activists, by being outspoken, by, writing the books and you know, just making sure that we continued this new life that we had now been given.
You know, and it sounds like also, too, that we model. As a parent, you model for that child. And him being proud of the way that you've responded and acted, it's also, too, that's you talking to you through him. He could not have been the way he was if it wasn't for the strength that his parents had, the way he was taught, the way he was brought up. And when you talked about, you know, he wasn't perfect, we're all perfect for who we are, and you couldn't get a better son for a mother, and quote unquote. That, so in our own way, everybody has their own perfect. I am my perfect. I'm never going to be anybody else's perfect, but I'm my perfect. And when we say they're not perfect, yes, they are. They're perfect for who they are, when they are, and how they are. They may not be perfect if we're comparing them to someone else, but if we compare them to them, what more could you ask for?
I agree 100%. And I think, you know, comparisons are sometimes very dangerous, you know, because it,
sure,
it indicates that you're not satisfied with yourself, you know. And if you're satisfied with yourself, then you develop a life for yourself that brings you peace and happiness and love. And if you're not satisfied with yourself, then your job is to create the changes that are necessary so that you will be happy with yourself, but not making those changes because of somebody else, making them because of yourself, making them because of things that you've determined or weaknesses maybe in your, you know, approach to people or studies or any number of things, unhappy with a job. Well, you have the power then to change the job. You know, you're unhappy with relationships. Well, you have the power to change parts of your personality so that, you know, you will be more acceptable. But you shouldn't do it because somebody else has told you. You should do it because it's important for you personally. And then you have a very lovely, wonderful life.
No question. By the way, how are the other kids handling it now?
Well, two of my daughters joined the Army right after September 11th. Christopher's two younger sisters, and one of them spent 13 months in Iraq and 14 months in Afghanistan. And that was at the very, very beginning of the war. She's out of the Army now, and she's a mother and, you know, doing fine. And Megan is also out of the Army. She's my youngest child. But my oldest daughter's husband joined the Army because of September 11th. He also spent time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and fragmented our family in a very, very profound way. You know, we were one of those old-fashioned families that dinner together, and we ate every night. That was one of my rules, that we spend some time speaking to each other, no matter how short the time was, that we have a time when we met. And so dinner was the time that we met. And after September 11th, you know, we were all disjointed because two joined the Army and one, you know, whose husband joined the Army went up to Alaska. And so our closely knit family now was, you know, kind of scattered. And it was hard, and we weren't able to talk to each other about this event. Now, we're all able to talk about Christopher, and we talk about him all the time, and my grandchildren feel they know him because we speak so much about him, and he is a part of our conversations often. We mention things about him and his personality and you know, things that they do that remind me of Christopher. I tell my grandchildren. So he really is not physically around us, but he's around us in his spirit and his passion for things and his, you know, interest in America. And so we mention this all the time, and that's helped us all. That's helped us all.
Now, by the way, when September 11th, 2001, were you still teaching?
I had retired in July of 2001. My husband had retired the year before, and I really hated the fact that he was in bed in the morning and I had to get up to go to work. So I decided, you know, as soon as I had the right age, I was going to retire, and I did. So I retired for all the right reasons. And I often think, you know, had I been working, I probably would have had to have either taken a leave of absence or, you know, retired. And that would have made it very difficult for me because I was retiring because of something else and not because it was the time for me to, you know, have a new life, you know, and Al and I were going to travel, and we have traveled, but, you know, that didn't happen right after September, you know, 11th. But, you know, I retired for good reasons, and I'm very comfortable with that and very happy that I was able, you know, to say I had a wonderful career. I loved being with the children. I absolutely loved, you know, teaching, and I was a staff developer, and I helped other teachers, you know, in their classrooms, and I loved that as well. But I retired. For me, it was the right time, so I was very pleased that it was not as a result of this event, but rather that it was on my own terms.
No, by the way, what it sounds like with your background, your experience, it sounded like that background helped you get through a lot of this.
I would say that's probably true. And I would also say that, you know, I had very, very strong parents. My mother and father believed they were doers. They were people who volunteered in their life. They spent the better part of their lives helping others. And so that's the environment that I grew up in. And, you know, that we also grew up with a very strong belief in God. And that got me through this terrible event. And I felt very grateful and very blessed that I had this gift given by my parents to get me through. But they really kind of started the road for me, you know, and I continued, you know, I guess, you know, as a teacher and an educator, and, you know, I always felt that there were lessons in every single situation, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote the books, because I wanted children to learn the lessons that came out of September 11th, you know, and they're important for children to know.
Oh, sure, no question about it. By the way, your son-in-law, where was he in Alaska? Where was he stationed?
He was up in Fairbanks. He was stationed in Fairbanks. He was sent to South Korea for a little bit of time, and then he was stationed in Fairbanks, and my daughter was up there. It's freezing in Fairbanks. Absolutely.
By the way, he and I were up there probably at the same time.
Is that right?
No, I spent 23 years in Fairbanks, but I was there on September 11th, and I was there until 2002. No, I was there until 2005. So we were up there at the same time.
You probably were up there with Eddie. That's right. And Jennifer, you know, lasted a couple of winters, and then she said, I can't stand the cold anymore. And she came home, and, you know, he finished. And then he ended up being deployed, you know, so she wasn't going to be able to be with him anyway. So, but she hated the cold. It's freezing in Fairbanks.
Tell me, we got to. I was from Los Angeles when I got there, and I got used to it real fast. But you could get to, you know, 35, 40, 45 below zero. But like anything else, you get used to it. All right, let me ask you this, Maureen. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes. I have a couple of websites. There's Christopher's website that you mentioned at the beginning, www.christophersantora.com. And then I have another website. It's Maureen, M-A-U-R-E-E-N, at MaureenSantora.com. And the books are available on both places. They are also available online at Amazon. So they can be purchased there. And I have a third book, The Day the Towers Fell, which is the story of September 11th. You know, also a picture book, you know, for children.
Thank you. By the way, Maureen, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I enjoyed our conversation immensely. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. We're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Kim Hasarud with us. She's the author of Mojitos 101 and Other Muddled Drinks. She's a James Beard honored mixologist, an author, a beverage consultant. She's the founder of Liquid Architecture. She conceives her signature cocktails much as Alice Waters would create a specialty dish, taking inspiration from market-fresh, high-quality ingredients. And let us say, Kim, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you for being here. I got two questions. One is, did I pronounce your last name right?
Yes, you did, and I'm very impressed. I get that it gets butchered so often that I'm used to it, but you did a great job. It's Hasarud, that's right.
Hasarud. Okay, and now the next one is Mojitos. Did I say that right?
Mojitos?
Mojitos.
So the J sounds like an H, Mojitos.
It would be Spanish then, Mojitos.
Right, right. It's actually a Cuban-based drink.
Ah, okay. Well, then I got to start the whole intro over again. We're going to talk about 101 mojitos and other muddled drinks. By the way, I have always felt in my heart of hearts that anybody who mixes a drink, it's kind of like an artist. An artist paints a picture. It's created. And food in a restaurant, when it's set in front of you, there's got to be that look about it in addition to the taste. A drink is the same way, isn't it?
I absolutely, totally, 100% agree with that. A mixologist is, it's almost like a chef, but a chef of liquids instead of food. And there's some good synergies there. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, is crafting a drink, is it like baking, where you have to really be precise with the measurements, or does it work, or is it more like cooking, where you can kind of throw ingredients together and make it work? And it's a little bit of both. Most cocktails have a very specific formula you need to follow, and if you veer from that or you take liberties with that, you throw the whole thing off. And I think that's why when so many people go to bars and restaurants across the country, and they may have a mojito or a margarita, often it'll be too sour, too sweet, and it's because the bartender didn't follow a very specific formula. But it can also be a lot like cooking in that once you understand that formula, then you can get really creative. Then I can throw in different herbs and throw in different seasonal ingredients. But I think that's a really key difference in using really following a base formula and also really incorporating fresh seasonal ingredients, much like a chef would into a cocktail.
Now, by the way, what I'm hearing here, which is very interesting, somebody walks in and orders a drink. It's not just give me a scotch and water. It's like ordering a malt, ordering a health drink, ordering a something. There's so much to drinks if the mixologist knows what they're doing, and if you know how to order, then it's like going in and getting a malt, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. You know, and I think we're actually, there's a whole cocktail revolution going on right now, and I say we're actually moving forward by taking a step backwards. Back in the mid to late 1800s, to right before Prohibition, there was a whole cocktail revolution. I mean, a bartender was a very prestigious occupation up there with lawyers and doctors. It was a very crafted occupation. It took, you know, maybe a 3-year apprenticeship just to get behind the bar. But after Prohibition, I mean, it completely crushed, you know, an entire industry that had, you know, thrived for, you know, almost 100 years. So we're just now getting back to that place. It's interesting, if you go back and you look at some of the cocktail books from that time period, I mean, some of the creations they were creating were amazing, and I think that's a really wonderful, great thing to see nowadays. A lot of bartenders are now pursuing this again as a vocation versus an occupation. So I think you're going to see a lot of that in New York, San Francisco, all over the country.
No. By the way, I knew I was in trouble when I was going to do the interview because the book got put in front of me and it's got a rope around it. Because as soon as I'm done, it's getting yanked to the other side of the desk. Susie Greenman, Radio Susie's daughter, she's specializing in what?
Pastry,
etc. And she also, part of it in college, got a bartender's license. So there's a battle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so there's a battle for who gets the book. I think I lost.
That's great. Where? What part of the country is she living in?
In the Milwaukee area.
In Milwaukee, okay. Okay.
Yeah, right around there. But that's what it is. I for the life of me, I still don't understand why going as a pastry chef you get a bartender's license. But in thinking about it, there's got to be that element of creativity, just like you're talking about. A pastry is not a pastry, right. And a drink is not a drink.
Right. I think there's probably some really good synergies there, too. You know, with being a pastry chef and bartending, I mean, bartending definitely teaches you a lot of people skills, you know, because you're definitely in front of the guest and talking to them and kind of find out what their needs are, what their likes are, and it really gives you a grasp on who your audience is, you know, much more so than, you know, cook in the kitchen, which they're back there the whole night and they don't really get that guest interaction. So, you know, in a way, by doing both, she kind of is getting the best of both. You know, kind of getting to know her guests and also being able to create both things behind the bar and as a pastry chef too. So
no, by the way,
a great way to pay your way through school.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I think realistically, you know, the world is changing, the culture changes, society changes, drinks change, and you're right. There's a whole different look, there's a whole different feel about what it is that's offered out there today. And you've got to be quote-unquote branded. You've got to be different than everybody else. And it doesn't matter what market you go into today, 25% of that market is loaded with alcohol. And no matter where you go, you're going to find it. So why just have alcohol? Why not have something that you can totally and absolutely enjoy? And I'm on page 73, and I'm into Granny Smith. I'm into
which drink are you looking at?
I'm at 73. Granny Smith. That's the green apple chunks, the lemon juice, the simple syrup, and the vodka. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean that's a really great one for the winter time. You know, for a while the apple martini was all the rage. You know, about 7 or 8 years ago. And this is, you know, I have a lot of drinks in the book where I utilize apple in much more innovative ways, and this is a great example where you get to use you know, a dessert wine or an apple brandy. And there are some, you know, amazing Calvados, which is, basically a brandy from France made from apples, where you can utilize a lot of those things. And, you know, I'm really a big fan of using market fresh ingredients. So not necessarily following a cocktail book, you know, looking for a recipe and going out and making it, but rather kind of flipping it on its head. So going to your produce market or your farmer's market or even the produce aisle in your grocery store, finding some really great seasonal ingredients to work with, and then building a drink around that. So that was a lot of the inspiration for a lot of my drinks in this book, as well as my other ones as well, is just really, you know, really making the ingredient be the star of the drink versus, you know, just following some recipe and kind of incorporating things into it, really making the ingredient shine.
Yeah. Now, by the way, and I wonder how many people would even think about this. I'm on the cranberry Lederhausen. Okay, how's that?
Okay.
We're talking mint leaves. We're talking about cranberries and simple syrup and cognac and limbic beer. I wonder how many people actually realize that the ability to have a drink is not just to have a drink, not just to have a beer, but the creativity that can go in and around it. And I will bet you any amount of money that parties, it would make all the difference in the world when somebody sat down and had something like this.
Oh, I can't tell you what a difference it makes. I mean, I love it when people, you know, when I'm working behind the bar or doing an event and people come up and they just think they're going to order, you know, they're just getting a regular drink or a mixed drink from me, and then they have something and they're really blown away by all the different senses that are enticed. I mean, you have your flavor, you have, you know, the visualness of it, the aroma of the garnish on it. You know, they all have a purpose. And there are the really, as far as the ingredients you use, the world is, you know, you have a world of ingredients at your fingertips, especially now when, you know, you can order global ingredients online and so forth. But in this particular one, you mentioned the cranberry Lederhosen, I did use a Belgian lambic beer. And that's a great ingredient in a drink. It's really full-bodied. It's sweet, so I don't have to add a lot of sugar to the drink. I actually love using beers in cocktails. It's actually a really big trend right now in some of the big mixology bars. It's a really great one.
Kim, where was it for you? What got you started with this? What was that certain something that said there's more to a drink than just pouring a drink?
You know, I lived in New York City for about 10 years, and I was working in the entertainment industry, and I was always a bartender to supplement my income. And that's kind of where this mixology movement in the United States started, was in New York City. So I really started to get into the craft of creating cocktails, and I really enjoyed it, but I never really thought, I don't know if this is something I really want to do for a living, being a bartender. I didn't really know how to transition that into a career. But I, in working in the entertainment industry, I was also able to go to a lot of industry parties. So I went to a lot of movie premieres, and I was really blown away at how much money was spent at these events. I mean, these producers would spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a single event, and so much time and resources and money were put towards the food and the decor and the entertainment, but the drinks were always an afterthought. And if you looked around the room, every single person had a drink in their hands, and I thought, gosh, if you put a little creativity into that, gosh, what a difference you could make with someone's overall experience. You know, I mean, because the drinks, again, they never really matched the greatness of the event, but if they just, you know, approached it from a different way or put a little creativity or added fresh ingredients, wow, what a difference it would make. And that was kind of the genesis of me starting my consultancy, Liquid Architecture. So when I moved to L.A., that's primarily what I did. I started kind of a drinks event, kind of a consultancy, and I worked with Maxim Magazine and some other event producers, and eventually segued into a lot of hotels and restaurants started contacting me about creating great culinary cocktails for them, and eventually started working with a lot of the big liquor brands. And that's now primarily what I do, is I travel the country and I teach mixology, and I work with a lot of hotel chains and hotel groups across the country, and just teaching about mixology and how to make great drinks.
You know, it's wonderful. The America is still that way. If you have this idea, there's nothing that can stop you if that idea seems to be workable. And as far as drinking goes, take it all the way back to the Great Depression. You know, what was the two things that people spent money on? There was, I mean, they were worse off than we are today. And it was booze and entertainment. And that's been a constant.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, and that's, I think a lot of that is true today. I mean, our, you know, times are definitely not good for some people, but you do find some solace in being, you know, in being entertained and having a great drink, especially if it's a well-crafted one.
Yeah. Now, by the way, is it possible to use any of these combinations, any of these recipes, and can you use anything? Can you replace the liquor with something?
For the most part, I would say yes. Kind of the basics of a mojito is lime juice, simple syrup, rum, and mint. But if you wanted to not use rum and you wanted to use a vodka, you could certainly do that. Technically, it wouldn't be called a mojito, but you could definitely mix your alcohol. I mean, you could use a cognac, you could use a brandy or even a gin, which I do all throughout the book. But I really think, you know, if you notice in the book, I do have kind of a core formula, which is usually one part lime juice to one part simple syrup, because you really have to get that ratio right of acidity in the lime juice to a sweetening agent. But other than that, I really go crazy. I do lots of different combinations from, you know, gin and watermelon and basil to, you know, blackberries and blueberries and rum to, you know, Grand Marnier and cranberries and beer. You know, I really do lots of different combinations. But, it's just kind of understanding that basic formula, you know, kind of that one-to-one ratio of simple syrup and lime juice or any kind of a citrus acid. And then being able to get creative from there.
I'm looking at the blackberry cobbler. Okay, you got blackberries, you got blueberries, you got lemon juice. Again, the simple syrup, etc. Right. And I'm getting thirsty looking at it. I got the one problem, and for some reason, my entire life, I have a low tolerance for alcohol. If I drink one drink, I'm under the table. I'm gone. I'm done. So, a lot of these things look good. If you just didn't put the gin in it, I would be great, and then I wouldn't be embarrassed to ever come out in public again.
Yeah, you know, I would say, I mean, a lot of these cocktails, because they're really ingredient-based, you could definitely make non-alcoholic drinks, I would say, with the majority of these.
Yeah,
so, for example, that blackberry cobbler, you could absolutely take the gin and creme de cassis out of there and just make it to be more like a kind of a blackberry punch type drink.
You might even want to add
a little bit of club soda to it, but absolutely.
Yeah, no, by the way, I think
I've got two kids. I've got a 2.5-year-old and almost a 4-year-old. So anytime I'm doing drink development for some of my liquor clients, I'm always making a non-alcoholic version for them.
Oh, and by the way, that's always going to happen. Now, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at to find out more, buy the books?
Sure. You can find me at my website. It's www.liquid-architecture.com. And you can buy my book, 101 Mojitos and Other Muddled Drinks, as well as all of my other ones. This is my sixth book out of the series. The best way to do it is probably on Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Kim, thank you so much for being with us. It's going to be a fight after the show, but I think she's going to win.
May the best man win.
I got you. Good night.
Okay, good night. Thank you.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight.
I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And Carla Wilson with us. She is the author of What If I'm Right? Has spent over 19 years as a correction deputy at a correctional facility in Michigan. She's clinically trained in chemical dependency and mental illness, uses her education to inspire others to seek out their own awareness and spiritual enlightenment. She's the author of What If I'm Right? A personal experience that became a story that became a miracle. And let's say, Carla, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What was it like to be a correctional officer, a deputy?
Well, I still am a correction deputy, and I define myself as a person who's fascinated with broken people.
Yeah, and by the way,
I
think it was about 20-some-odd years ago, I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I was at the radio station there, and I got a phone call. There was a cab company that worked right out of the building that we were in, and one of the guys that worked for the cab company, where the drivers usually came up and bought advertising from whoever his rep was. So one day the cab company owner had been killed, and they caught a couple of these guys at the airport, you know, with the bloody weapons and money and so on and so forth. So I'm sitting in my office one day, and I get a phone call, and it's from this guy, and he's in prison, and he's saying something's wrong here. I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Aren't you in jail?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, but this is wrong." And psychically, he said, "You had a psychic on the air, and I was wondering if I could contact her because I shouldn't be here." And I said, "Okay, I'll call you." And I called the chief of police, who I knew, and the mayor, and I told them what happened, and I said, "I'd like to find out why they can pick up a phone and call and other things." And they said, "Okay." So we set up a deal, and they came down and arrested me, and I went to prison for a couple of days. And I got to actually live it, you know, when they dressed me down into the blues, and when I was with lunchtime and dinner, I was with everybody right there. And at night, I went over to the quote unquote day room. But before I walked in, they told everybody who I was, so I wasn't, you know, infringing on the privacy. And it was a very interesting experience. And obviously, when I went to sleep that night, they put me in solitary, and that was something else. And I got out the next morning. But when they closed those doors, even though I knew that I wasn't arrested and I was going to get out, it was a very scary feeling. And I can imagine that there is, and for what I was exposed to for 2 days, a completely different culture. It's got to be like being in a different planet. And working with that has to give you kind of a different mindset, and you've got to be able to turn it off when you walk out.
Definitely. You're right on so many levels. The correctional system definitely is a culture of its own, and you have to learn to speak the language, and the officers as well. And one thing about that population with officers, we have the highest suicide rate, addiction rate, and divorce rate. And it's a sophisticated situation. You have to work in it without taking on the characteristics of the environment. And it's tricky, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, you know, for officers, for inmates, for family members, because if you haven't lived it, it's hard to understand it. But there's a universal message through it all. I believe it or not, I started out as a dance major, and one of the things that I remember is, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah,
and that's just one of the philosophies that I use.
Let me tell you one of the other things that I took away from there also that would have to do with the topic and what we're talking about with, you know, the What If I'm Right. It was very interesting because I got to talk to a lot of the guys that were in there. The only place they wouldn't let me go into was the pretrial thing with the television. But other than that, I was with them all the way across the board. There was a lot of them that, you know, everybody had found God and so on and so forth, and obviously everybody was innocent. That's that. But the other thing that I thought was fascinating, which I really got a hold of and understood, the recidivism rate is tremendous. People who have been in jail end up going back to jail because there's a, again, that culture. You're there, you're fed at a certain time, you exercise at a certain time, you know exactly what life is, and you're protected, it's secure. Then they get out into the public again. They can't deal with it, and they go back.
Right, right. Yeah. Recidivism is high across the United States, and that's something that I've added in the book, not only the stories and the lessons, but at the end I put in resources for the inmates and the families. I put in some websites like the National Hire Network, the Ex-Offender Job Search, expunging your record so you can at least find out if you have a charge that is expendable, a Family and Corrections Network. One of the big barriers for people is having that support system. When you don't have the support, the resources, you do wind up back in the system. So some jails and prisons are focusing on reentry, and some just don't have the funding, and they don't. And that is, you know, just several of the reasons why the recidivism rate is what it is.
Yeah, and by the way, they know how to deal within the system itself. They get back out into public, they don't really know how to deal.
Exactly.
And
there
was a few of them that I talked to, quote unquote, all of a sudden they got religious, and you know, when they got out, it might be a completely different thing. But I was listening to a lot of the stories as we sat there at the tables, and everybody was innocent. Nobody did anything, and it was always the other guy. And it was fascinating to watch. The other thing I thought was interesting, we got down to Chow, and one of the guys I had met there, he's looking at his watch, and he's saying, well, they're 2 minutes late today. They're a minute and a half later than they were yesterday. It's called, they're watching. They got nothing else to do, so they're making sure everybody does the job they're supposed to do, and they're watching everybody.
Yes, that's true.
That's true.
What was it in there that for you became special, that you got to live out, that you got to, you know, people go through life and they really don't find what they love to do. What was it for you? Where is it that miracle came for you?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. And now remember, I'm still there. I have about 5 years left before I retire. And what happened for me is I found my inner voice. I decided to go back to school to get my master's. And during that journey, I began to listen to my inner voice. And I decided when I took my first test, I was going to listen to my inner voice and not change the answers on my first test. And if I got a perfect score, that's the way I would do it throughout. So through my 4 years of graduate school, I got 1 B+. The rest were straight A's. So I knew I was on to something. So I decided I was going to assist the inmates in listening to their, training them how to listen to their inner voice. At the time, I was in a direct supervision unit where it was 60 men and me for 10 years. So what I would do after roll call is I would turn the lights down, I would put music on, and I would walk and talk to them and teach them how to just basically meditate. And that was just the beginning. And what I would do is help them create a new vision for their lives beyond their release. And some people got it. And I'm one of the few officers. I work in the recovering community at a treatment center. And I would often see the people who got it. And they would run up to me and say, I've got a job. I created a vision. This is what I got. This is what I'm doing. And thank you so much. So that became, you know, just my goal is to help as many as I could find a different voice and find a different path and just reconnect with themselves. And that was my miracle, to see that happen in other people. And it was a gift and a privilege and definitely my miracle to see that happen in other people.
What I think is great, there was a woman that I know that's very big in finance. She came from a life of poverty, went to the military, ended up on the street homeless, and then went to school and ended up getting a degree in finance. And she spent her life and is spending her life today teaching other people how to stay out of debt and so on and so forth. And she would walk into a she would walk into a room with a lot of people who were in real trouble with credit cards and so on and so forth. And she'd say, okay, what are the first steps? How do you stay out of debt? And they would say something like, well, you know, don't use your credit card. Watch this. You know, buy the inexpensive meals. And the list went on. And when they got done, she'd look at them and she'd say, the first thing you have to do to get out of debt is see yourself out of debt. And you caught it spot on. Because if you don't have that visual, if you can't see yourself doing it, it's never going to happen.
Exactly, exactly. And when it comes to finances and things like that, more institutions nowadays are using local colleges and universities. In the block that I supervise, we would have classes like money management, parenting, AANA, creative writing, diversity classes. So it was a win-win for the universities around, because it would give them a chance, the students a chance, to begin teaching a population that might have been caught in the cracks that would never make it through school. So it's a good thing to do things like that and have, you know, students have an opportunity to teach this population.
Oh, no question.
I got a lot out of it.
And look what they get by teaching that population. That population is... those that will listen, and the ones that, as you said, what they got it, there is a yearning inside of them for somebody to spend the time with them. If they would have had
exactly.
that in the first place, they probably would not be where they are. So in essence, what they were missing, they're getting there, and then they've got that they've got that experience of what it feels like now, so they can recognize it when they get out. If you can't recognize it, you can't put your arms around it.
Definitely, I agree. Wanting to be heard, wanting to be valued. I know when I was in school, I would often have the inmates quiz me because they would want me to do well. And I think that was the reason that I did do so well, because I was able to use this time. Instead of just walking around supervising, I was interacting. And early in my career, believe it or not, I got in trouble from one of my supervisors for interacting. They're like, Wilson, we're not social workers. Just do your counts. Get out the units. And now... you know, forward 20 years, we have to get in the units. They want us interacting, and we get in trouble when we're not doing that. So now it's a mandate. So it's interesting how, you know, how things change with different administrations.
And by the way, even whether it's an administration or what, a human being is the constant throughout the whole thing. Look at kids. Kids want to be recognized. Kids want to be accepted, and kids want to identify with something. And if they're not going to get it at home, they're going to go find it someplace else. And usually they get in trouble for whatever it is, whatever area they're accepted in and what they do to stay with that acceptance. And then a lot of them end up in jail. And it's that very reason, I think, what you're doing is you're bridging that disconnect that they had that caused them to get in there in the first place. And once they
exactly.
can realize, yeah, there you go. Yeah. Are they coming back to you, and are they writing you letters after they're out?
Yes, they are, and I see them out and about. But when you just address the children, I have an opportunity to speak at the universities, and sometimes they'll bring in kids from middle schools. And once they find out that I'm from a jail, they flip the conversation. They want to know what their lives are going to look like when trouble hits, when life is hard. You know, what that looks like, what does jail look like? Not that they're anticipating going to jail, but that's what they're fascinated with. When things don't work out. Now, see, this is something they don't teach in school. When things don't work out, what do? When your marriage doesn't work, divorce, devastation. And I can remember a child that I was babysitting when she was 9 years old. She plainly asked me, is my life going to be hard?
Yeah. No, I got it loud and clear. There was a
mm-hmm.
program that they were taking through the high schools probably 20, 25 years ago, if not longer than that. And it was about going to jail. It was about what happens when you do go to jail, how tough it is if you're not getting along. And I can't remember the name of the program, but there was a tremendous amount of kids who watched it and realized that this isn't what they want. And I would venture to guess it turned a lot of their lives around, too.
Definitely, and some agencies are doing that. I have a Connection Principal, that's my company, and what I do is get former inmates, and we go out and we talk, not just to kids, we also talk to parents, to we did a mother's group, and they had sons in prisons, and it was called MOIST, Mothers of, I can't remember the what it stood for, but they got a lot out of, I took all male inmates with me, and they connected, and they related to the men that had just got out of jail, and they talked about what it was like being away from their mothers, even at 40 years old.
Sure.
And, yes, the connection was definitely there, and I encouraged the gentleman that went on my panel to mingle at the end. I'm like, they need to hug you. They need, you know, because some of the guys were standoffish. I said, sure. Because you represent their loss. So be there for them. And it was a healing night. So I get a chance to go to prisons, high schools, colleges, and I often take people who've recently gotten out of jail. Also, by working at a treatment center, that's where I pull my people, because that's part of recovery, telling your story. And I was at this treatment center, and this gentleman told me he was once an officer and showed me a picture of himself. He wore the same uniform that I wear. And his life had spiraled out of control. And I had, and he was homeless at the time, and I had no idea. So we definitely have a bond, and I used him the last time I spoke at a university for a group of social workers that were just about to graduate. And we just talked about, you know, how important their role was. And he said, you would have never guessed that I was at one time a detective.
Now, by the way, there's something called transference, and I think a lot of counselors run into the same thing. They work with people who are having major problems, and there's something that happens that sometimes they can't distinguish between their own problems and the person's problems, and they begin to take those problems on. And that can happen in a facility that you're talking about, because let's face it, this is not the normal person that's in jail. And when you're dealing with them and you don't have a goal, if you're not focused in where you want to be, that transference can happen, and all of a sudden you're living their life without consciously being aware of it.
Exactly. That has happened. I tell you, there's nothing sadder than having one of your coworkers that you've worked with for 12 or 13 years now locked behind bars.
Yeah.
Because they've crossed the line and went over and lost themselves, and they just weren't aware that that professional distance somehow it just faded away, and now they're on the other side. But yes, that does happen. And sometimes inmates do target officers and say, I'm going to take you down, and they make it their mission.
Sure.
That has happened to several of my coworkers.
How do you?
That's all a part of training now.
Okay, I was just going to say, how do you shore yourself up or protect yourself from that?
Education and self-help. Having mentors, people in the field, that having healthy people around you. Those are some of the things I address in my book as well.
Okay, by the way, when you decided to write the book, what was it that caused you that aha moment, that epiphany moment that said, I've got to put this to pen?
You know, my book started out as a grateful journal. And while I was in this room with these 60 men and in school, I said, you know what, I'm going to jot some of these things down. So the things that I became grateful for, that the book wrote itself. And as I would share things with the inmates or philosophies, just short little one phrases, it would come up to a one-pager. And I said, you know, if I would have known this 15 years ago, it would have saved me a lot of heartache. So that's how the book started, as a grateful journal. Because that unit that I supervise is my laboratory, it's my classroom. I learn more from broken people, from somebody who's lost everything. Now that's when you learn a lot, when they've lost everything.
Carla, I hate to do this. We're running out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes. I have a website called connectionprinciple.com. But if you go to Amazon today, Amazon.com, and put in What If I'm Right, or put in Carla Wilson, you will see it. And the cover has a large pair of handcuffs with an open end hanging from a cell bar. But it has a universal message. You don't have to have someone that you love incarcerated or have been incarcerated. It has a universal message, because pain is universal.
Carla, hey, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your work and your time and who you are.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, good night.
Okay, good night.
There isn't any more we've shared a moment. And as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.